Hi, and welcome to Plants and Shit. My name's Tim Harper, I'm a landscape designer, and I run a plant and coffee shop in Adelaide.
Hi, and I'm Stephen Reed. I'm a landscape designer, speaker, educator, and sense of place specialist based in the small Victorian town of Macedon. Our podcast is For Creatives by Creatives, and each week Tim and I will be talking plants and shit with artists, designers, and thought leaders from all walks of life.
We want to learn what it is that makes our fellow creators tick and discover the common threads that we share.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Plants and Shit. This time we speak to interior designer and founder of Austin Design Associates, Fiona Austin. We chat about Fiona's involvement as president of Balmoris Modern and how important it is to protect well-crafted buildings of any age. Enjoy the show. Okay, today we're speaking to Fiona Austin from Austin Design Associates. So welcome, Fiona.
Thank you.
And we'll be talking a little bit later about your website and Instagram, which is Balmoris Modern, and your new book as well. But just a little bit of background about, so you've been an interior designer now for quite some time running this business, since 1999?
Yes, yeah, 21 years I've had my own practice. And then prior to that, I worked for other people. And then prior to that, I used to write about design for various magazines and The Age.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just a little bit more about that. So, where do you work in your area? Like, who are your clients and what? Not, you know, don't name them.
But yeah, sure. Now, we're residential, and we do a lot of renovations. I did study restoration and conservation. Didn't finish the course, but studied that in my youth, so I have an ongoing interest in period architecture. So we work a lot in renovation, and we do a lot of work in Bayside, obviously, because that's where our office is, but also we'll sort of go anywhere for a good house. So we've just been working on a house in Ballarat, beautiful deco house in Ballarat.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of lovely deco houses in Ballarat.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, no, and there's also, oh no, it's Ararat. There's a house in Ararat designed by the same architect that designed the Heidi Museum.
Oh.
And so it's like a little tiny...
McGlashan Everest.
Yes, that's what it is, yes. I couldn't remember the name.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just clapped at
30. That's right. Sorry. It was actually a clap of excitement.
So, it's a beautiful, beautiful house. And it's like a little mini Heidi too. And it's... The whole of Ararat calls it the odd house because it's nothing like the rest of the houses in the street. And it's just off the main street. And I went there to look at helping them design the garden. Ended up, they didn't get the job. I don't know why. But I had a look at the old, a little bit like you looking at the drawings for this house, the old drawings of the house. And my ideas for the garden were reflected in the original architect's idea for the garden. So the way I wanted to break it up, he had already thought about that.
Yeah.
But then we're going off track, but we do go off track with this podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
He had actually already thought about that. So the house was really well designed for the garden, but then somewhere with the intervening years, the garden had been pulled apart and it was just the house sort of marooned on this block with no divisions in the garden, no screens or anything.
Mm.
And so I was walking around with the client saying, well, you know, it feels like it should be a screen here and that's really too open and why don't we... And then they showed me the original drawings. I was like, oh, okay.
You're on track.
It was absolutely on track. And that's why I was sort of confused why I didn't get the job. Because I was basically telling them just to reinstate the garden.
Yeah. They probably did. They probably thought,
Maybe they did. Save them a lot of money.
Maybe they did the old trick where they got what they needed.
That's right.
And then, we don't need you anymore.
Well, because every time I made a suggestion, they would smile. And I couldn't work out why. It's because I was basically telling them to put the old garden back in.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've always been interior design has been your, passion?
Yes, it has. Yeah. I have done a few other things, but yes, interior design's always been my passion.
Yeah. Do you ever find like a grey area between like interior design and landscape design? Do you ever cross over into the... Because we're sitting here and I'm seeing a beautiful garden behind you. Do you ever feel like exceeding the lines of the house, or is it more... You just prefer to get inspiration from what you see in that garden, for example, for what's in the house.
Well, I mean, I think I respect other professionals. Yeah. So I love, my ideal project is when there's a great architect, great landscape architect and interior design. So I think when you work together like that as in collaboration, there's an overall much better result.
Yeah.
And so I always encourage clients, I'll say early on in the project, be considered a landscape architect and suggest someone appropriate.
Yeah, from an early stage too.
Yeah, from a really early stage.
Often landscape ends up being sort of the afterthought sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think for a large portion of the industry, but I think there is obviously the same people that you deal with as clients, they do understand the importance of getting all the ducks lined up right from the start and design. And we'll be talking about mid-century modern homes in a second, but that sort of whole idea of the house and the garden being one, as at least thought of as the one property, which people don't necessarily think of. They think, well, there's walls, and what's on this side of the walls is the architect and interior designer, and what's on that side of the wall, and they shouldn't talk to each other. It's like, well, actually, you know, maybe we should. And my clients do understand that. So, but I often need to push, I find. So I don't know why, but for whatever reason, the architects I've worked with, the only reason why I've worked with them is because my client has said, you have to work with our landscape architect. And so we've had to, the clients force the collaboration. So it's interesting that you extend that as well.
Well, I think it's good to have that professional respect. And, you know, and not try and do everything, you know. I think that if you respect what each person does in the project, then you get that really amazing result. I just think it must be hard for an architect to try and do, you know, to discuss with a client how do you wash your clothes and where do you put your dirty clothes and how do you cook and then how do you garden and how do you barbecue? Yes. I mean, surely it's better to kind of have different people coming together to resolve those.
And of all of them, the architect's kind of the one that has to extend into all of those areas, but
know their limitations. No, it is interesting, and we'll I just want to delve into this a tiny bit more in that I've only really understood that more recently, where I've worked with architects to design their own garden. So it's not a client of theirs, but it's their garden. And so they've designed and built their own house, and I've walked through and thought, okay, architecturally, this is a stunning house, but it desperately needs an interior designer because they haven't finished things. And I was kind of taken back by that. I thought that, wow, this amazing architect who's built this amazing house hasn't thought about the way the blinds sit or the way the door closes or and actually hasn't thought about those things, or the cupboards in the kitchen hasn't. Just the practicality and the things that an interior designer would do. And it sort of struck me of, no, there is sort of a blurred division, but there's definitely a division of labor. There's the architect understands the fabric of the house. The interior designer understands, you know, the light fixtures and how the TV swings in and out, understands the furniture, understands the flooring, all that sort of thing. But an architect doesn't care about that. They just want the building. And I don't think people know that. I don't think they realise that we each have to have... You, as the client, you have to get the team together.
Yeah.
And that team has to be architect, interior designer, landscape designer, even gardener. You know, all of those people need to be involved right from the start.
That's interesting, because we, in another interview or podcast we've done, we were talking about the language this person had used in the book that they've done, which... language, you know, like in the landscape industry, it's language we would use all the time, but it's easy to forget that, like, a client may never have heard some of the words we're talking about that we take as normal. And it's almost a case where you have to remember to educate the client. So, you know, a lot of people wouldn't even think and shouldn't have to realise all those different roles because they're overwhelmed because they're already spending money on this and this and this. But sometimes, you know, you've still got to explain it to those people.
There's just so many levels of detail.
That's right.
And if you really want to do a project properly, I think you've got to consider all those levels and get the appropriate people to work on them.
Yeah, absolutely. Excellent. Look, we'll have a little break and we'll come back and speak a little bit more about Balmoris and the history of Balmoris and all these lovely buildings around the place. Tim and I really enjoy bringing this podcast to you. So don't forget to subscribe and rate, because that helps other people just like you to find us. And of course, if you want to hear more of this podcast, please go to our GoFundMe page, because every little bit counts and it costs a lot of money to sound this cheap. Fiona, welcome back. And let's talk a little bit about this area of Balmoris. It's even been mentioned on Tim Ross's program. I rewatched it the other day. I thought, oh, well, I'm going there in 2 days' time. So it's clearly a very special location, a special area that's got an interesting sort of bohemian almost sort of history to it. So can you tell us a little bit more about the history and why is there such a, this area exists of so many mid-century modern homes?
Well, it's got a really interesting history. So what happened was the area was bought before the Second World War. Most of Balmoris was bought by the Dunlop Rubber Company, and they were going to do a garden city. So they were going to have people living here, working here, and then ship the rubber products off from the bay, which is Balmoris is on the bay. And then, and also before, well, after the war then, there was a huge fire that went through Balmoris. So any early houses that were here, any sort of the odd Federation farmhouse or interwar house, pretty much burnt down. So after the Second World War, there was this huge tract of land by the bay, not that far from the city, and it was really ripe for development. Dunlop pulled out. There was a housing shortage. So it was just this spot. And so it, I think because of all the native trees and the proximity to the bay, it attracted artists and architects and creative people. And that's where it all started.
Yeah. And so a lot of those people, are there a lot of creative people still in this area, or is that sort of disappearing? Is that...
Well, I think it still does. I mean, the Balmoris Art Group has been going for 60 years and still going strong. I think we do still have a lot of, well, Balmoris Modern is full of designers. Our committee is all pretty much all designers. So I still think it does attract people for the architecture and the and trees.
And I was just thinking about this house. I mean, it's only a 14-year-old house, but it's been architecturally designed. Has a lot of hints of mid-century modern architecture in the fact that it faces north, it has plenty of natural light. So clearly architects are still interested in this area. It's, there's still, you know, that history is still moving across, except then you look across, unfortunately, from you, and hopefully these people don't listen to this podcast.
Yes.
But you've got a really hideous McMansion straight across the road. So unfortunately, obviously, the cancer of McMansions are coming into the area. Is that one of the reasons for the book and for the just sort of trying to let everyone know that you've got this gem in this area?
I mean, I think part of the problem too is that a lot of the houses built post-Second World War were very modest, and a lot of those early architect design houses were quite experimental, so they were, there was a material shortage and they weren't very big and the rooms were quite small. So I think a lot of people without the knowledge or the background of that architecture would walk in and go, well, let's bowl it over and build a, you know, a mass-produced house. So we get big shiny rooms and home cinemas and walk-in robes and big en suites, whereas we're sort of encouraging people, we're saying, we'll keep the house and maybe do a wing and, you know, extend it.
And there's a lot to be said about the sense of place of an area, and Tim's going to laugh at me because I talk about sense of place all the time, but that idea that you move somewhere because of the way it feels or the architecture or the you know, just it's nothing visual, it's just how you how the place feels, and you're attracted to that. And then the people who are attracted to that end up destroying it. So you have this beautiful bayside suburb full of trees, full of beautiful natives, right next to a golf course, lots of open space. And then suddenly things get built that have nothing to do with what was here before.
Almost out of context.
Completely out of
context.
Yeah. But of course, if that is allowed to continue happening, the context will change completely.
So that was why we set up our group for Morris Modern, because we thought if we can build awareness and knowledge and understanding of this architecture that we've got, because a lot of perfectly nice people would move here and not understand the Indigenous landscape and not understand the history of the architecture. They would come from Malvern or St Kilda and just have no idea that modest little house was important or that the tea trees were important, and better to have the tea trees than plant your, deciduous inner city trees, So
particularly, as you pointed out, the very sandy soils here. You don't necessarily... You can garden anywhere as long as you can... You respect the conditions of the site. Mm. And you can't have a Malvern garden in Balmoris because the soil's completely different, the climate's completely different, or microclimate's completely different. And people don't often get that.
No.
And then they complain that they can't garden in Balmoris. But it's actually, well, you can, you've just got the wrong plants.
Yeah. it's a bushy native suburb. Right. And if you don't like bushy native suburb, maybe this isn't the right suburb for you.
That's right. So how long has the committee been together? How long have we been running?
Well, we officially set up Balmoris Modern as a community-based group 2 years ago.
Okay. So really, I must have started following you straight after you started.
Yeah, I started the Instagram and the Facebook page quite a while ago. I mean, I think I originally started that as a way of matching people with houses, because we'd put something on Facebook or Instagram and it's happened. Someone from Northcote who's looking to buy their family home would see it and come across here on a Saturday and actually buy the house.
Yes.
So we were trying to match up people with
like
the houses.
A house Tinder.
But it actually worked. It was actually working. So we were getting the word out there of, look, this is great house and it's original and it's this price, and we attract more people to the area to look at that particular house.
Well, particularly if, as you said, there's no train line through here. The major sort of highway basically bypasses Balmoris. Mm. You don't really know it's here unless you know it's here.
Yeah.
And so I would assume that there are probably lots of people in Melbourne or in Australia that really value mid-century architecture, but don't realise this is here. Mm. So don't, they appreciate it to a point, but not enough to go and research and find out where you can buy really beautifully designed mid-century homes.
Yeah.
No, that's really interesting. Because I do notice on your Instagram that you do talk about when houses are up for sale, and it's quite a positive. Often these... all the mid-century ones that I follow are usually quite positive, but a lot of these sort of where you're trying to save a type of architecture, like Sirius Building in Sydney, for example.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
That's kind of, there's a lot of negativity around that because people are so desperate to save that building. It's their language that they use is quite negative in that, because they're fighting the council, they're fighting the developers, and that sort of brings the tone down. Whereas I notice with mid-century, and I guess it's a slightly older architecture, so people are now rediscovering it. Do you find that? Do people rediscover this architecture?
What I found really interesting, for example, with the book, is that people my parents' age love it because they built it. Mm. People my age love it because they grew up in it, and people my kids' age love it because it's cool.
Yes.
So it has this really broad appeal.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. That's right.
It's interesting you say it's old enough. Like, it's slightly older than that building in Sydney.
Yeah.
It's probably also more widely in the general public seen again as a, like you said, cool. Like, it's quite publicised style of architecture, whereas the brutalist is probably, like... The average person that's not interested in architecture would probably see it and go, it's hideous. Whereas this...
Well, that's the argument. A lot of people say that it's an ugly building. Okay. Yeah. Like, every time I go past it on the bridge, it's like, I want to live there.
But if you had sort of 15 minutes to half an hour to go in there with someone and explain to them why it's designed like that, most people would understand and they would look at it different. But, to someone who has an interest in it, like we'll do, you kind of take the time to go, oh, it's like that for a reason.
Yeah. And I think that's part of our, that's been part of our remit for Beaumaris Modern, because there still are a lot of people that think only Federation and Victorian houses should be heritage listed, and they don't understand why we want to have these houses protected. They just don't understand. So we have found by having our events, and we have our open house event, and we have events at the Mid-Century Bowls Club, and we have the book, we've actually increased the interest in, and we've, I don't want to say educated because it sounds elitist, but we have actually inspired people to understand why we're so passionate about the architecture. You've sort of given them the
information to sum it up.
Yeah, and we've explained who the architects were and what their background was. And for me, the most important thing is that, you know, much as I love Federation and Victorian architecture, if a Victorian house gets demolished, there is another one.
Yes, that's
Whereas
right.
Whereas if a McGlashan Everest house in Beaumaris gets demolished, or a Peter McIntyre or a Neil Clarahan, that's it. There's no more. They're gone.
Do you find it's easier to preserve and look after the houses that do have named architects? Because a lot of these houses, they may have had named architects, but they were project homes.
Yes.
And so they're kind of, I was about to say they're kind of the McMansion of their time, where that they were pushed out. But they're obviously
They're not.
So that's why I stopped myself.
They're the merchant builders of their
time. That's right, merchant builders of their time. Yes. So, sorry, I just happened to be... That's right, I happened to be looking at the house across the road.
Yeah.
But they were project homes, you know. So is it easier to conserve some of the houses that were designed as architecturally designed homes than it is to conserve the project homes, which are equally lovely and interesting?
Sadly, not, because what I've found is often the best architecture in Beaumaris was built on a really good site,
right,
or a nice big block of land, or overlooking the water. So,
which are all things the developer's looking for.
Yes.
But also, if people value the architecture, would actually allow the architecture to hold its value?
Well, you'd think. But, I mean, there's a classic one that's in the book, Mockridge Daly Mitchell on Beach Road. Mm. And it was, surprisingly, it was heritage listed a long time ago. But when the people that bought it purchased it, it was a complete wreck, even though it was heritage listed. So it was virtually rebuilt.
Yes.
So even though it was designed by a really important architect, if it hadn't been heritage listed, it would be three units now.
Okay.
And what saved it was the listing. And now the people that bought it spent the money to restore it and renovate it. And now I think it's... Now someone would walk through it and understand its value.
Yeah.
But when it was sold, they wouldn't.
Yeah.
So is there any sort of protection on any of these homes around here? Or is it... So say this, the Beaumaris Modern... didn't happen. Is it basically just up for grabs? Like, there's no, because it's not that old, there's no actually a specific thing to protect the feel of those homes in this area?
Well, technically there should be, because other areas in Australia have protected their mid-century modern houses. We've just got our council's got a really poor reputation for looking after any of its heritage. I mean, we've got an interwar house at the moment in Grosvenor Street in Brighton that's under serious threat. So it's Bayside Council.
Which to me seems crazy, because it's something that attracts people.
Yes.
Like people would come from interstate to walk around and look at these places.
And they do.
Yeah, and I bet they do. Yeah. It seems crazy that a council would not see that as a, you know, something that other councils don't have.
I totally agree. And we continuing to push for a proper study to be done. And our argument is, look, the study encompasses a lot of houses and it's a rigorous process, and people have, there's public hearings so you can put your other point of view forward.
Yeah.
And you can't just snap your fingers and heritage list a house. It has to go through the proper process, and that's all we want, is for them to go through the proper process and be recognised.
Yeah, that's that's a tricky spot, isn't it? So Is your position in this sort of, I want to call it a group, association, what would you, is it an association?
Community group.
Community group.
Yes.
It's really passion driven for something that you love.
Yeah.
It's not like it's for any other reason other than it's a tragedy if no one else tries to save these places.
I think it's our cultural heritage, and it's really, we see it as really important for the future to have these one-off important houses recognised and hopefully saved.
And there's nothing worse than seeing suburbs, even if they don't have particular unique architecture like this does. I know in Adelaide there's a few suburbs where you go into them now and you don't recognise them. They all look the same because, you know, all of the bungalows or whatever the particular era was have made way for the square block multi-dwellings. And yeah, you just feel nothing when you're in those spaces. They don't have any meaning. That's a value that's hard to...
You also think... I'm just sort of thinking about places like, maybe not Malvern, but the Glen Iris and all those sorts of areas where you do have interwar buildings and they seem to be protected. Like, they don't seem to be knocking them down as quickly as... These, and they're only like 10 years younger or 15 years younger.
Are these older, on a bigger block though?
No. No, there's some really big blocks in that area.
A lot of councils have done a lot of work to look after their heritage. I mean, I kind of find it bizarre that a very basic little Californian bungalow in Spotswood has protection and a Robin Boyd in Beaumaris doesn't, But I think the thing we've been trying to get across to people who are frightened of heritage is that there's probably 100 houses in Beaumaris we'd like to see protected. Mm. There's 5,000 houses in Beaumaris. So if you're a developer or you want a new house, there's plenty of options. Just don't pick one of our beautiful original ones.
That's right. And there's something about this area that's unique. And as you just mentioned, it's our cultural heritage. So there's a cultural heritage here that needs to be protected because it actually does add value even to the new home that's next to it. Mm. You know, it's people move here for a reason. If you take that reason away, then it becomes less valuable. And I don't understand why people don't get that. You know? Mm. Sorry, I'm being militant. I should shut up now because
that's a good point.
But it is one of those things where, to me and to everyone sitting here,
it's a perceived value thing again.
It's crazy that you wouldn't do it. I just don't understand why. But then you say it's also education. In that, look at the Sirius building. It would have been demolished by now if it wasn't for so many people saying that they love the building. And because I think the developers and the state government are actually shocked that that building is loved because they think it's ugly.
Mm.
And I also think that these, how do I want to say this, sort of modest homes, because they are single level, because they are modest, because there's only one bathroom, maybe two if you're lucky. There's definitely not an ensuite on every bedroom. Because they're modest, people think, oh, well, they're valueless. But as you say, they're part of our heritage.
And it's also, I think, the simplicity. Like, we're trying to save the Beaumaris Art Group building at the moment, which was designed by two architects because it was built at two different times. And one of our local councillors said in council the other night, and I'll quote, "Oh, I walked past it and it's not much of a building."
Yeah.
You know, so that's the kind of uneducated view because it's simple and it's pared back and it's got a beautiful form. And it's not all look at me with arches and lead light windows and columns.
We love our white columns, don't we?
And again, Tim Ross mentioned this on his program. I've also heard it described in other ways, but the idea that something has to be around for 70 years before it has a value, like an architecture has to be around for 70 years. And firstly, do you think that's true? Do you think that the reason why we're now wanting to save these buildings is because they've been around for just long enough for people to value them again? Secondly, so that's sort of the first question. And the other way I've heard that described is the idea of a pendulum. So architects and landscape architects and people who understand design swing the pendulum one way and say, okay, people, we know what's good for you. You're going to have this beautiful architecture. And then that happens for 10, 15, 20 years. And then the pendulum swings the other way because they think it's elitist. And so then people want their columns again and they want their neoclassical and they want... And do you think that sort of maybe a seven-year pendulum swing or what? Why do you think it comes in and out of fashion is my question, I guess.
Yeah, I think because I'm an interior designer and I've worked for a long time and I've worked on a lot of projects where a lot of effort, a lot of design effort's gone into it with the architect, the interior designer, the landscape designer. And I think that when some of those projects are finished, they should almost be protected, yes, because there's been so much craftsmanship and effort, yes, and thought, and let's face it, not many people have the money to do that either. So I think they almost need to be protected because they're unique and they're special, and they're putting Australia on the map, right, you know, internationally, as that's far right as our architecture goes. So I don't think there's a time frame, yeah, no, you know.
And I'm leading into social media now, in that if there is such a thing as that weird pendulum swing, do you think social media has now shortened it to being very, because you can tell with social, you can get a following very quickly with social media. And I think the reason why the Sirius building is still standing is because of social media.
Mm.
And I have a feeling that the reason why your book is so successful and people like me are following you on Instagram is because of Instagram. I would not have known about you.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have known that Balmoris is because I'm not originally from Melbourne, Balmoris is this mecca for these wonderful architecture. So, yeah.
No, I think social media, I mean, Facebook originally, which is what we started with, was brilliant. Like, because I used to lie in bed at night thinking, how can I save these houses and how can I connect people up? And so social media has done that, and it's brilliant at that. But I also think that people are really discerning. Like, once I put something up on Instagram and it was a house that I think was originally weatherboard, and I think they'd bricked it in the 70s. So I sort of said, and I've learned not to do this now, I sort of said, oh, you could bag the bricks or paint them white.
Yes.
And all these people reacted and said, oh, you can't paint those bricks, you know. And it was all sort of like, yeah, but I don't know if the bricks are original. I was thinking of how you could renovate it nicely.
Yeah,
that's right. So people are really quite purist. And I'm surprised at how purist people are, which is great.
Which is great. That's right. It is great. Really good.
It can be great. I mean, they say people will be more upfront about than they might to your face if you were saying it in a conversation.
Now we're coming to the end of our time, so where are you going from here with Balmoris Modern? How can people sort of support you? How can people spread the word? What's the thing that we're hoping to achieve with this?
Well, probably a few different things. Like, it's great for us to get members, because we can go back to council and say, well, we've got 400 members, paid up members. It's great for people to follow us, because we can say we've got 6,000 followers. We have our open days once a year. Yeah. We have walking tours. Yeah. We're doing a walking tour app. Yeah. So we've got lots of things people can participate in. And even if they're from interstate, like we had the Canberra Modern people come to our last open.
Yeah.
So we've got lots of events. Follow us, buy the book, join Balmoris Modern.
Do you have to live in the suburb to be a member?
No, we've got members.
Okay, you're about to have a new member.
Yeah. means you get information. We send you out heaps of information about all sorts of stuff. Yeah, and we partner with the National Trust for the Heritage Festival, which is Australia-wide.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we also are interested in Canberra Modern, Adelaide Modern, Geelong Modern. Yeah. We sort of think maybe eventually we could have an umbrella group.
Yeah.
So when something like Sirius happens... Yeah. Yeah. We can all band together to try and... So the more people that belong or let us know they're out there, the more we can work together to create, you know, interest in the architecture.
And as you keep pointing out, once it's gone, it's gone.
Yeah.
You know, you can't rebuild any of... Particularly if they're a notable architect who's no longer with us. You can't get... you can't rebuild
it. It's gone. And with this really sad case last year, we lost a Chancellor and Patrick House. Yeah. And... it's just tragic. It's a block of land still. Mm. Nothing's built there. Mm. And it's just the saddest thing. I mean, we've all said, we'll never let that happen again. Yeah. We will actually chain ourselves to the building and we won't let go.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's how determined we are.
But it's also like I mourn the loss of wonderful buildings when I see... there was an Art Deco petrol station in somewhere on the way to... somewhere near Elstonwick, I can't remember exactly the suburb. And it was a triangular, and it still had its SO sign at the front, and it hadn't been used as a petrol station for years, but there was absolutely nothing wrong with it. It was beautiful. And I kept driving past thinking, I want to buy that, live upstairs, because it was two-storey, and the old petrol station turned that into my studio.
Yeah.
And that's, this is my dream. I'm going to buy that building one day. And one day I was driving past, and there was only two-thirds of it left. that had been knocked out.
Yeah.
And I almost cried. Like I had to stop and I had to take a breath. Yes. And but people who don't understand architecture and just say, oh, it's just an old modest house, let's bowl it over, don't realise people like us actually mourn.
We do.
We mourn the loss of those buildings. Yeah.
And you have a you have a visual memory. Yeah. When you're a creative person, I think I have that all over Melbourne. You sort of have the memory of what was there.
That's right.
And I mean, I probably wouldn't mind so much if a building did come to the end of its time and it did get demolished and it was replaced by something interesting, like a really good architect in a new building.
That's right.
But most of the time they're replaced by quick profit developments, and that's really upsets
me. So rarely happens. Mm. I mean, look at the poor old Greyhound.
Yes.
You've never seen the Greyhound building, but it was a beautiful building that had only just been renovated like 10 years before. And then I drove past one day and there's a hole in the ground.
And there's still a hole in the ground.
There's still a hole in the ground, that's right. Well, thank you very much. This has been a great talk. I actually wish we had another half an hour or so with you because I'd like to chat a bit more about this. But you've definitely got another couple of members for your community group.
And we'll put all the information on our Instagram.
Absolutely. And we probably should take a little selfie. Now, do you worry?
That's what he does.
No, that's fine. Just so we can. We'll end that there. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To stay up to date with our future podcasts, be sure to connect with us on Instagram.
We'd love to hear your thoughts and answer your questions. You can direct message Tim at Space Capsule Garden Co. And you can direct message me at Stephen Reed Landscape on Instagram. And to make sure you don't miss out on an episode, don't forget to subscribe.